I'm Phil C.
And I'm Lynn.
And together,
we're Roman Oz.
Real interviews.
With real people.
On location.
With a great mix of Aussie music.
As requested by the people we interview.
Follow us on Facebook.
Or check us out, romanoz.com.au. All interviews are live.
And on location.
And may vary in audio quality from segment to segment.
So, Phil, what's on the show this week?
Well, Lynn, we're starting off the program in Tasmania.
Yes.
At Low Head.
Yes.
And I'm going to be chatting with Cindy. Now, Cindy, she's responsible for the penguin tours in Low Head.
That's correct, the Low Head penguin tours, and they are an amazing thing to go and see when you're there.
Absolutely sensational little creatures, aren't they? And how yes. knowledgeable.
She was very knowledgeable. Oh, can't say that word. And, she could hear the penguins coming in the water before we even knew they were there.
Absolutely amazing, this lady. She's been doing it. Apparently her parents, I think, were the ones responsible for setting it all up.
Yep, starting it.
And now she's doing it. And she is so accustomed to what they do, these little penguins, and her ears are so attuned to what's going on out in the water.
Yes.
That we were all just standing there, you and I and lots of other people, and she's saying there's a group of them just out there and they're going to come out here in a moment, and we're all thinking, oh, yes, this is all part of the show. But she can actually talk to the penguins. She knows yes. what they're doing and where they are and explains everything.
Yep, they're having little conversations to themselves.
Absolutely brilliant. So if you're ever in Low Head in Tasmania, definitely – definitely make sure you go and do the penguin tour and ask for Cindy in particular.
And make sure you wear warm clothing.
Well, that's true. That's
true. We were there in January and it was freezing cold.
It was a little bit chilly, Lynn, I must admit. But it was worth it, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
It was sensational.
Yep.
Now, after that, who do we chat with after
we're
that?
We're chatting to Ron and Zanette.
Right.
And we met them at the Low Head Lighthouse Precinct. And they took us through the small museum that was there and also the lighthouse.
The museum, you know, they started that themselves.
They did, yes, collecting bits and pieces.
Bits and pieces and
yep.
What do they call it? Flotsam, jetsam?
Yep, that sort of stuff, yes.
That sort of stuff that they had this massive collection because obviously they walk the area, walk the beach and so on and so forth, see interesting things, pick it all up. And they had so much of this at their home, they said, you know what, we should set up this little museum.
Yep, and it's great for the kids, a learning tool for the kids.
Absolutely sensational, those two people. It is a learning tool and there's so much to see. And you know what, it's free.
Yes, it was.
Although,
and also go on a Sunday when they blast the foghorn on the lighthouse.
Well, yes. Now, we were about to mention the foghorn on the lighthouse. If you're going to go there for this foghorn, make sure you take some earplugs or something, because the foghorn is louder than a jet engine.
Yes.
And it vibrates and reverberates
right through your body.
through the ground and through your body. And again, a really fantastic experience.
It was.
Now, thirdly and lastly?
We're chatting to Ken Wilson from Caravan Truck Friendly, and he's talking about cane trains up in Queensland.
That's right, because the cane season is now upon
us. Sugar cane
is now upon us, the season, and of course there's massive trains that haul all this sugar cane, and the roads where these trains cross are not very well marked.
Oh, aren't they?
So
right.
You kind of have to look out for things like flashing lights and bells.
Interesting.
And very interesting. And whatever you do, and he does tell us this in the chat we had, don't try and race against a cane train, because if it's going to cross and you're trying to beat it, you're going to come out second best if you miss. miss your timing and run into one of these trains. Now, look, apart from all these fantastic conversations and interviews, we've also got a great selection of music
as requested by the people we interview.
So, Lynn, what do you think? On with the show. G'day, listeners. Phil C here. This is Roman Oz, and we are at Low Head, and I'm chatting with Cindy from Low Head Penguin Tours. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Fabulous. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. First of all, I want to say what an incredible tour we had last night. It was a bit windy afterwards. We were going to chat with you last night, but you made a good judgment call. It was a bit cold. You could see us trembling, and we're doing it now in the boathouse, which is absolutely lovely. So, first of all, tell us about yourself, Cindy. How long have you been doing the tours?
I've been doing the tours between 14 and 15 years.
Okay.
I started doing the tours because the owner at the time needed a guide, as the guide had passed away, which was my father.
Oh.
And she said, well, I need another one now, so I started.
So you took over from Dad?
Yep.
So how long was Dad doing the tours for?
Probably about 5 years.
And how long have you been doing the tours?
Nearly 15.
Nearly 15. Amazing. So did you used to go on the tours with Dad?
Nope.
Not at all?
Not at all.
Because last night, as you were wandering through the sand and pointing things out to us, you were able to hear every sound of what was going on in the water. You were telling us about how the birds are out there, the penguins are out there, and they were communicating to each other. How long did it take you to pick that skill up?
It takes a little while to stop the background noise.
Right.
So you have to stop the wind in your head, the waves, and then when you get past that, then you'll start hearing the birds chatter. So you hear the birds in the water. They sound like ducks. You will hear the birds on the land talking to them.
Right.
And then you will hear a couple of other different styles of birds there telling each other stories as well.
Wow. Amazing. So you're the penguin whisperer of Lowhead?
Apparently, but no, not quite.
So you've been with them for 15 years. Dad was 5 years before. When did the tours start?
So the tours started in 1996. There was an oil spill out at Hebe Reef, which is just out from us, and the Iron Baron ran aground there. And they had to collect the penguins as they had oil on them.
Okay.
And once they'd done that, Parks and Wildlife needed people there to monitor the area, and a group of locals started the business.
Okay.
And then one person kept the business running, and she was there until last year. So she was there over 20 years.
Okay.
And that's how it started.
Wow. Amazing. So what types of penguins can people expect to see when they come on one of your tours?
So the penguins all around Australia are the same.
Okay.
So they are fairy penguins, but you can also have them called little or blue,
uh-huh.
but their scientific name is Eudipula minor. Still the same penguin.
Eudipula minor. Eudipula minor. Okay, I'll have to remember that. Now, tell us about the penguins. They're blue penguins, you said. Now, on the tour last night, you said they've got the very distinct blue on the top, white underneath. What is the idea of that?
So the blue and white works really well because they are a bird of the ocean. So the blue, when predators are flying above, they cannot see them because they're blue like the water.
Mm-hmm.
Predators that swim underneath them, like sharks and seals, cannot see them because they're white like the sunlight.
Okay.
Put them on land and they don't match.
Yes, well, I can imagine that. And they're not very fast on land. We saw them hobbling about last night as they came out of the water. Tell us a bit about that. First of all, one penguin came out. He was lone, standing on the shore, having a bit of a surf, and he was looking around everywhere really curious. What was that all about?
So it's usually a young male.
Okay.
He wants to show the group how awesome he is at it. So he will come out. He will check the area to make sure it's safe. And then once he believes that it's safe, he will call the other birds out of the water.
Okay. And it's always a male?
9 times out of 10 a male, but a younger male. An older male won't do it because he's not stupid. So a younger male will do it because he wants to show the group he's a great leader and he wants a female.
So when you say young male, what's the difference in age between a young male and an old male? When they're silly and when they're smart?
Well, a younger penguin that comes out is over 2, but they're very close to 2.
Okay.
Older penguins can range up to 9 years old, but we have actually tagged our penguins in 1995 with the oil spill. Penguins that come out of the water have to be 2 years old.
Okay.
They can be older, but they're definitely 2. And that is what we class as a younger penguin because they're only just starting to come out to learn what they're supposed to do. We still had a tag bird from 1995, 6 years ago, so they actually were over 20 years old.
Wow. But that'd be rare, wouldn't it? Because there would be predators. They're very well disguised, obviously. But what do you think the average age of a penguin would be? He's probably the senior, 20. Would they last 10 years easily? Or
I would say 10 years would be a good estimate around here in our area, because they don't need to go that far for food. If they had to travel constantly, then they're food for other animals, but their area here in the Tama River is their main food source.
So when you say up to 2 years of age before they come out of the water, they live in the water for 2 years?
If they want to.
If they want to?
Yep.
Okay, so what do they do for sleeping and so on? So they must rest. They can't just swim for 2 years.
So what they'll do is they'll sit on a rock.
Okay.
They'll have a nana nap in the ocean if they want to. Penguins are polyphasic, which is they only need a few minutes sleep every few hours.
Okay.
So they can lay on top of the water and have a really quick sleep, a solid 10 seconds. Or they will lay on the land.
A solid 10 seconds. A micro sleep behind the wheel of a car and you'll be dead with that.
Yep.
10 seconds of resting. Wow. So tell us the difference between the male and the female. How can you distinguish them?
So a male has a larger head and broader shoulders than a female.
Uh-huh.
Honestly, can't tell the difference. The difference for me is the beak. So
right.
The male beak goes along and turns down at the front.
Right.
A female beak is flatter. They still have a little bit of a chipping tooth at the end of their beak, but it's not like the males. The males goes right down at the front.
Okay. And what's the diet? What do they live on, the penguins, the fairy penguins?
So here in our area, their food source is in the Tama River. So we have a seaweed forest in the Tama River that has sea horses, sea dragons. They will eat that. They'll eat crabs, bait fish and squid.
Okay. And you mentioned last night, tell us about their beak structure. You mentioned about the way their teeth are designed in their beak.
Yeah, so they have areas inside their beak which are bone areas that look like teeth, but they actually go backwards.
Right.
So they suck in live food, and when it comes back up, they chew it to kill it.
Okay. So the idea, if one comes close to you, don't think, oh, how cute is he, and try and pat him on the head.
Never pat a penguin. I don't care how cute they are. They can look after themselves quite nicely. If you put your fingers near their beak, they will shred all the meat off your fingers.
Wow. Now, how large are these creatures? Because you imagine something that's going to shred the meat off your fingers.
I know.
How big are they, the penguins?
So, honestly, they will be around about 33 centimetres. But if you think of a school ruler, about 45 centimetres, that's pretty much what you're going to get. A male may stretch out to look really big because he wants a girlfriend or 10.
Okay.
But normally it's about 33 centimetres and they only weigh about a kilo and a half.
Okay, so they're a very cute looking animal, but obviously don't try and pat them or pick them up or do any of that kind of stuff because it's just not good. Yeah.
No.
So what about their mating cycle? What age do they start to mate? Because you said 2 years before they come out of the water. So what age? Is that when they start to become sexually mature enough?
Yeah. So once they start coming out, they're actually coming out to get ready to breed.
Okay.
So the males will come out and get the house ready. That's their job. And once they've done that, then they will call for a female. They'll sing. But the problem is every male will call for her because they're all trying to get that one girlfriend.
Right.
Even if they have one, they're going to go for another one. There's a backup girlfriend just in case the first one doesn't come home.
That's perfect. I like
that. Wow. Rude. So once they've done all that, the breeding cycle is she's gone, yes, okay.
Yes.
10 days later, they will have eggs. Most of the time, it's two eggs.
All right.
They actually can have three if they believe they can look after the three.
Okay.
And 35 days to incubate the eggs.
Okay.
Parents swap over every 5 days on the eggs. They don't actually sit on them all the time because they will go outside of a night time and play with their friends. And then the babies are born after 35 days and then both parents feed them that whole time for 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then the kids are ready to go into the ocean and the parents abandon them and they've got to figure it out themselves.
Wow. So from 8 weeks, no more assistance from parents.
Nope.
And the next 2 years more than likely in the water.
Yes, because they only should come on land to breed or to lose feathers.
Now tell us about the feathers, because you mentioned last night they've got like 12,000 feathers, is that correct?
Yep.
And you were saying that they've got to prune these feathers because of... Tell us about that, the pruning.
So penguins have an oil gland and they need to make sure that that oil goes on all their feathers. So okay. they are continuously preening. So they have 12,000 feathers. Every feather must have oil on it. Then they will clamp that feather shut with the one next door. And so no water gets onto their bare skin.
Okay. For the reason being that they could die from hypothermia
yep.
or...
Yep.
And you mentioned that they can actually drown?
Yeah. So if you could imagine the layers of feathers, if you have water in between the layers, that's extra weight on them.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're not healthy and they're not really thinking about it, then they're just going to drown.
Wow. Now, you did say that they also shed their feathers.
Yep, so once they're mature, so 2 years and on, mm-hmm. every year they must shed their feathers. So once a year they will go and eat as much food as they can to double their weight. Once they've done that, they will come and stay on the land for 20-plus days.
And it takes them 20 days to shed and to have new feathers.
Yep.
So one's pushing out the other.
Yeah, so they're not running around naked.
No.
So they do have new feathers pushing out old feathers at that time.
Oh, good. As you can tell, listeners, she's got a wonderful personality. Cindy's her name. I think we've just about covered it all, haven't we? I think, Lynn, you were at the tour last night. Is there anything, Lynn?
No, I think you've covered everything there.
You've covered everything. Mm-hmm. So how often do the tours go out? Let's just for the benefit of the listeners, and how do they go about making a booking?
So you can book on the website. If you're unable to do that, by all means, you can call the number and we can do that for you. The tour runs every single night.
Okay.
We run about 15 to 30 minutes after sunset time.
Okay. And the reason for that is?
So the birds will get ready to come out, but they need to do that talking and tell each other stories in the ocean. And then when it's time to come out, it has to be dark. They just do not match anything on the ground.
Okay. And that's obviously for self-preservation
yep.
to come out in the dark.
Yep.
So how many penguins do you think you have out there?
We have a few thousand in the area. You will never, ever see that many.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones that are coming in are curious to see who's on the land, or it's breeding time or molting time, or Fred's coming home, so Peter wants to come home and see why.
Okay. Fabulous. Amazing stuff. And you've been doing this for 15 years. You're obviously going to do it until you can no longer do it. It's a passion for you.
Oh, I think they're amazing.
They're an amazing yep. creature. And I must say, for anybody who's in Low Head, it's definitely something recommended by me
awesome.
And also by Lynn. And if you do decide to take a tour, listeners, make sure you ask for Cindy, okay?
We have some guides and I can promise you they're all just as good, thank you, if not better.
They're all just as good, but they're some of the younger ones, listeners, don't judge them by age or appearance because
oh,
the younger
not.
Ones... I've got all the skills because they've been
100%.
Taught by Cindy. So Cindy, you pretty much run the show, don't you?
Yes, the old boss retired last year and I learnt everything off her. And some of our guides are from that generation
okay.
and the new ones coming through are learning as well.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
So how many guides do you have?
At the moment, I think we've got 14.
Wow.
Yep.
And how many people, last night you had about three or four guides, I can't
yep.
remember. And how many people did we have on the tour last night?
I think all up in the end it was 55.
55. Mm. So how many people, what's the maximum amount of people you've had on a tour?
There is no such thing as a maximum.
Okay.
Because I can put a certain amount of people, customers, with as many guides as I need.
Okay.
And the area that you went last night, I have that plus around the lighthouse, plus around the back of us as well.
So it's a huge area.
Yes.
And if a big crowd of people arrive, don't think, oh, gosh, we're not going to see anything. Look at all these people, because you're going to have more than enough guides and more than enough area to take each individual group.
Oh, yes. We're never, ever going to impact the penguin area.
Uh-huh.
So you will never have a huge group standing at one location. There are quite a few locations that we will put smaller groups,
okay.
just like we had last night, as you've seen.
Yeah. So the tour runs for about 45 minutes to an hour?
Yeah, depends on the penguins. Yes.
How excited the penguins are to come and meet and greet.
Yes. Yes.
I do have a question, actually, yes. Cindy. What about people with a disability, you know, a walking stick, a frame, a wheelchair? Can you cater for them or...?
Yes, so 2 weeks ago I had a amputee. We've had wheelchair, wheelie walkers, walking sticks. We had people that cannot see. We had people that cannot hear. As long as you let us know prior to coming, I will accommodate any ability ever.
Fabulous.
And we do have vehicles that will take you down.
Oh, okay.
To the seated area. Yes.
No, I didn't know that. I would have said I've got a sore knee. Can you?
Oh well, there you go.
Can you drive me?
No
down,
surprise there.
Can you drive me down to the best viewing platform? Cindy, it's been a marvellous tour last night and fabulous chatting with you again today.
Thank you so
much for taking the time to talk to us. I'm going to have to wind this up now. Now I always play an Australian song at the end of each discussion. Have you got a favourite singer, favourite...
Well, the group, so all the guides, we put it out there to see who wanted what, and we picked My Island Home.
By
Christine Arnoux.
Well, there you go. Thank you so much for your time, Cindy.
You're most welcome.
There you go, listeners. Cindy, and she is from Lowhead Penguin Tools. We'll be back with more Roman Oz straight after My Island Home by Christine Arnoux.
See, they say home is where you find.
G'day listeners, this is Phil C and you are listening to Roman Oz and we're at the Lowhead Lighthouse Precinct. And I'm with Ron and Zanette. How are you both going today?
Yeah, well, thank you.
Yeah, fine, thank you. Having a good day.
Thank you so much for inviting us down here. This is a magnificent place that we've got here. We've got a couple of things I'd like to talk to you about. Let's start with the lighthouse, and also you've got the sounding of the lighthouse. Before we get onto the sounding, tell us a little bit about the lighthouse, the history of the lighthouse.
Okay, cool. The current lighthouse was built in the 1880s,
right.
And it was built to replace one that was built in the 1830s,
mm-hmm.
But it was only made of very rough rock and very poor mortar, and so it started to fall to pieces. So the current one has just had its candle power updated from that period of time. In the 1920s, it got a fancy red band painted around it to make it more visible. The pattern or the character of the lighthouse is three short flashes,
okay.
And it works on a 360-degree rotation, so you can see it from whatever aspect you can see the lighthouse.
Okay. And you know how far that beam shines?
No, I don't know how far, but certainly far enough to see in our upstairs bedroom window.
Now, what about the horn? You've got a horn there which is very loud. You said it was as loud as a jet engine, correct?
Correct. Yes, yes. The associated foghorn that matches the lighthouse in as far as its pattern is concerned was installed in 1929, and
right.
All that equipment was brought over from England. Somehow they man-hauled it or horse-hauled it into place. And in the 1970s, the powers that be decided that such archaic or primitive type of signalling wasn't necessary, and so they decommissioned it.
Right.
Then in the early 2000s, a group of volunteers decided that it could be restored. And so from that time on, every Sunday at noon, we sound the foghorn, giving you three short blasts at 126 decibels, and you can hear it up to 30 kilometres away.
Wow.
It's the only one of its type still operational in the world, so we're very keen to preserve that piece of our maritime history.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and the three short blasts occurs every 1 minute, so as long as the foghorn is sounding, you're going to hear three short blasts, 126 decibels every minute.
You think 126 decibels, as loud as a jet engine, does it vibrate and shake the foundations?
It certainly does.
Yes.
The foundations within the building, they shake, and the bedrock out the front where the resonator or the horn is placed, the bedrock vibrates, and if you happen to be standing under there, you vibrate too.
Wow, incredible. So obviously you've got to be wearing hearing protection.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Absolutely, yes.
So on the Sundays when you do this, do you get a large crowd of people who come to experience this?
Well, we do, yeah. There seems to be an increasing amount of interest in the foghorn, and we've had 70-plus people most Sundays in recent weeks. So, very pleasing, the interest.
Mainly tourists, or do you get a few of the locals who wander up here on a Sunday, or they're just happy to hear it from there?
Yeah, it's mainly tourists, but yep. We do get locals that do come up quite mm-hmm. regularly to have
okay.
a listen, because I mean they can hear it from distances up to probably 10 km away from here.
Yes,
and on a good day, the sound will travel 30 km out to sea.
Out to sea.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, goodness me. Well, we're going to come up on Sunday and try to listen to that. Now, let's talk about the education centre, because this is amazing. This is where we're standing right now. And I understand, Ron and Zanette, you guys put this together yourself. Tell us about this incredible centre and why. Why did you do it? Where was the inspiration?
Well, the heritage section of Parks and Wildlife actually controlled this section of the building. And they have a problem with rising damp, being an 1830s building, it hasn't got very fancy sort of a structure. And they invited us to use the building so it could be opened up and let it breathe a little bit more. So stemming from that, when we finally got the keys to it, Ron and I decided we could put a marine education centre together and have a place where young people and old people could come and learn a lot about the local marine environment.
Mm-hmm.
With very few exceptions, what we have in here are specimens that have been picked up locally, either by us or donated by other people.
Okay.
And we hope that people who come in will actually go away having learned something about their local marine environment.
Well, look, you've taught me. You've got shells out there. Tell us about the shells that burrow into other shells, because I knew nothing about that. And also the little bit you learned just yesterday about the blue bottles.
Yeah, well, these are just two little educational snippets, I guess. And you might have heard of a moon snail, which is a carnivorous marine snail.
Right.
And what his purpose in life seems to be is to burrow through the sand till he finds a bivalve, a little pippy or something similar. He then wraps his foot around it so it can't escape, and he has a special type of tongue called a radula, which is a saw type of protrusion. He then uses it to rasp his way into the shell by making a hole, continually rasping. He then injects some enzymes into the marine animal inside, which makes it into a soupy type of consistency, and then he sucks it back out and says, "Thank you very much, lunch done."
Sounds like a Stephen King movie. Sounds like some sort of a horror creature, doesn't it? Yet it's just a harmless little shell that you'd see on the beach, and you would have no idea what this guy is capable of doing.
Oh, absolutely. And I think lots of people have walked along the beach not seeing him because he's hiding in the sand, but seeing the other shells with the holes in them and come up with various theories as to how they might have got there.
Correct, correct. Yeah. Now, what about the blue bottle? Because that, again, now blue bottles are all over Australia, and I've only found that out today, that they actually... Obviously, they ride on the wind and the currents, but you said something about how half of them go in one direction and half go the other?
Yes, well, actually, I didn't know this till yesterday, so I'm learning every day as well, which is really great. The blue bottle is just a visitor to Tasmania. It's not where they normally are, but they tend to turn up increasing numbers, I think, over the last few years. But their little floaty has got a slight angle on it, and there's a proper term for that probably, but it's got a slight angle on it, and half of them appear to have it angled to the left and half angled to the right, which means at least half of the population are going to get to float somewhere new.
Fantastic. So
pretty tricky.
And sting us poor innocent bathers.
Absolutely, and those tentacles can be a metre or more long, and being very thin and fine, then you don't see them.
No, they're a wretched creature. I don't know what their purpose is on the planet other than to upset bathers. Mm. Now, what about you? Before you did this, what did you actually do? What was your trade, Ron? Why did you decide, I want to put this education centre together?
Well, I was in business in Georgetown for 28 years. And when I retired, we both... decided to go ahead with this after some time, because Sandy had become retired because she was a teacher for many years.
Yes.
And both of us have an interest in our surroundings and like collecting specimens off the beach and that. And over a lot of years we had gathered quite a lot of items. And then when the opportunity came up here, it was sounded a damn good idea to me to empty some cupboards in my tin shed at home of all these items and bring them up here to display.
For everybody else to see and enjoy. So before you did put this together, because how long did it take you to put this together again, the actual education centre?
Probably about 6 weeks.
Six weeks, 2 months,
I reckon. And that was about 3 or 4 months ago.
Okay. Yeah. So it's only a recent addition.
Yes.
To this area?
Yeah, still a work in progress.
Still a work in progress. 6 to 8 weeks to put together, but years of collecting, would you say, Ron?
Yeah, I would say so.
3 years of collecting.
Yeah. When the proposal was first put to us, we really put in a dedicated effort to find things. So all the beach walks and that were done right across the north and northeast, we were finding a lot of items that were of interest. So we were carrying them home in the back of the car sometimes, some of them a little bit decomposed and a bit smelly, but anyway, they were fine after a while.
So what other things have you got out there, just for the benefit of the listeners? You've got the shells, Ron. What else would you have out there?
We have a giant crab, which most people think is one of the main exhibits here, and it'll be probably... 13 inches across, I reckon. So that's across the body. That doesn't include the legs. And we've got quite a lot of smaller crabs around it, just to show what's around the area. We have lots of other fish examples, photographs, charts of what's the native Tasmanian fishes and dangerous species, protected species, sharks, etc.
Yes.
So that's all interesting.
Mm-hmm. And you've also got this map with the various lighthouses, because apparently you've got a lot of lighthouses in Tasmania.
Yes, I think that we've probably got fairly dangerous waters around Tasmania. Mm-hmm. Being an island, there's a lot of water.
Okay.
So we've got a map here of the major lighthouses of Tasmania. And further to that, we'll soon have a lighthouse model, which will be interesting in its own right because it'll be six-sided and cut horizontally. So like a Rubik's Cube, you'll be able to flip it round till you see a picture of the Lowhead Lighthouse, flip it till you see, for example, Eddiston and again Matsaika.
Okay.
And then people will have an understanding that not all lighthouses look the same. And they come in various sizes as well. Some are really tall and some are very short.
Fair enough. Well, it's been fascinating talking to you both. Now, this is a totally free to come here. I understand you're not open every single day. So how do people find out when's the best day? Is it just the Sunday or could people come on another day? If there was a group, how would they contact you?
Well, we're open at the Education Centre when the foghorn sounds on Sundays.
Yes.
Probably between 11:30 and 12:30 would be guaranteed.
Yes.
If you're lucky enough to be in the area up here and we're up here working, very welcome to come in.
Of course.
And we open both the Foghorn Building and the Education Centre.
Yes.
So we have had lots of people in and we're very, very happy with how it's all gone.
It's fabulous what you two people are doing. I think it's, and especially for the young ones, for the children. One other thing I wanted to point out, you've got a chart in there or a board in there showing how long things remain in the water before they completely decompose. For example, a battery can last up to 1,000 years in the water.
Yeah, that's right. And things like masks, which are a new type of rubbish, 450 years. Disposable nappies, 450 years. So these are projected times, of course.
Yes.
But it's certainly a learning experience to have a look at that chart. And if there are people interested and they're a small group, they can actually make a booking to come through the centre by going to or calling the Lowhead Pilot Station Museum.
Right.
So extra times for people to come through is possible. Yeah.
Look, I think what you're doing is fantastic, and especially the education side for the young ones, because even myself, I had no idea that a tiny little AA battery could last 1,000 years in the water. And I guess lots of people just don't consider what they put in the water, do they? Out in the boat, the can or the bottle could end up over the side, and as you said, a face mask could end up in the water, and these things are not good for the water, but also for the animals that live in the water. Plastic in particular, turtles eat plastic, not realising what it is. So definitely a great idea what you guys are doing, especially the education aspect of it. And before we go, you've got this thing here, which is you can actually take a picture home. Tell us what that's all about, because you said it was a 10-year-old who came up with this.
Yes, we've got a table with some rubbing templates put on top of it, and a local boy, a 10-year-old, using his grandfather's 3D printer, actually created these rubbing templates, so you can put a piece of paper over, rub over it with chalk, and then you have your own picture to take home of a scallop or a cowfish or a lighthouse. Whatever you like.
Absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us, Ron.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, my pleasure. And I hope we get lots of interesting people come along. You have to have a donation box out there, okay? Shame people into putting a dollar in there because it's well worth more than that.
Yeah, we do have a donation box. And we would encourage people to bring a gold coin with them when they come up here.
It'd be great.
It'd be very, very helpful.
Well, I'm gonna make note of that. I'm going to say make sure you bring a gold coin because a dollar, what can you buy? You can't even buy a can of Coke.
No, and
we don't want to end it up in the ocean either. So a gold coin to meet you two fabulous people, be educated as to what's going on here with the lighthouse and the horn and so forth. Absolutely easy as.
Yeah, no, that's great, and we hope a lot of your listeners will come and visit us sometime.
That's the plan. That's the plan, Ron. I've got to wind this up now. My producer's giving me the wind up. What can I play for you? I always have to have an Aussie song. Who's your favourite Aussie artist? Who's your favourite song?
I think if you could find something from Paul Kelly that would suit the theme of our area, it would be greatly appreciated.
All right, well, you leave that with us, and we will put on a Paul Kelly track suitable to the area, and it'll be straight on, and straight after that, there'll be more of Roman Oz. So stick around, listeners, for Paul Kelly, and we'll be back with more Roman Oz. Thank you so much, Ron and Zanette.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
On a crowded beach in a distant time, at the height of summer, see a boy of five at the water's edge, so nimble and free, jumping over the ripples, looking way out to sea. Now a man comes up from amongst the throng, takes a young boy's hand, and his hand is strong, and the child feels safe. Yeah, the child feels brave, and just carried in those arms, up and over the waves, deeper water, deeper water, deeper water, is calling him on. Let's move forward now, and the child's 17, with a girl in the backseat, tugging at his jeans. She knows what she wants, she guides with her hand, all the boys cry inside.
Caravans have now moved to a brand new location, 11 Clayton Road, Heatherbrae is where you'll find them. Whether you're looking to sell, trade or upgrade, they'll look after you. Check out their range, Silver Valley, Hurricane, Paramount, Road Trip or their flagship Option RV. They won't be beaten on price, so get yourself a knockout deal today. They're open 6 days a week. Why not give them a call on 02-4987-5288 or check out their website, 7thstreetcaravans.com.au. G'day listeners, Phil C here, and this is Roman Oz, and we're at that part of the show when I get to chat to the very knowledgeable Mr. Ken Wilson from Truck Friendly Caravan Road Safety Program. How are you going today, Ken?
Oh, terrific, Phil. Always good up here in Bundy.
Absolutely. I'm jealous, mate. I'm going to have to come up there for a visit. You'll have to take me to the Bundy factory and, wiggle in vibe. If we harass them for long enough, they might give us a free tour. No, but you're definitely in the best part of the world, mate. That's for sure. I love it up there. Bundaberg is a fantastic place. I've absolutely been up there several times and always look forward to going through there whenever we're heading north. So,
Bundaberg has one of the highest caravan densities in Australia, if not the highest. I think it's second highest or highest.
Really?
Of caravan registrations per population in postcode 4670.
Wow.
Hervey Bay is just behind it, and I think 8 out of the 10 top postcodes in Australia are in Queensland.
Wow.
Everybody comes up here.
Yes. Well, it's a great state. The difference between summer and winter is not a lot as far as the temperature is concerned. No. So, good stuff. Anyway, mate, let's get on to our topics. Now, what would you like to discuss for our listeners today?
Well, we're coming into and probably started cane season.
Okay,
So let's keep an eye out for the cane trains. The cane trains, they can take quite a few kilometres to stop. They're very, very long.
Yes.
There's no brakes on the wagons. They do take a while to stop, and they can be a bit hard to see because there's no lights on the wagons. There's only the lights at night on the train itself. So keep an eye out for the flashing lights. Don't try and race a cane train. just pull up and watch and enjoy the experience.
Okay.
Because you will lose. They're pretty damn heavy, mate.
Well, and then how many carriages do they pull behind those engines?
Oh, look, they can have hundreds, and they're phenomenally long. And you know how they get around the corners beats me. But they're very, very long. What they often do is they take out the empties and that during the day, etc.
Okay,
Full ones get brought in at night after they've been loaded during the harvesting.
Mm-hmm.
So they run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Wow. And I suppose the thing is just be mindful when you're in that area, the cane area, and I suppose that the train tracks that cross the road, have they got barricades or anything or just lights and bells up there?
The ones on the major highways have boom gates and flashing lights.
Okay.
Now, especially later in the afternoon or early morning, some of those lights can be very hard to see because of the glare from the sun, especially if you're driving into the sun.
Okay.
So just be aware of that. Keep an eye. If you see a cane train driving down the tracks beside the highway, it's a pretty fair bet further up the road or just behind you, it's going to cross the tracks,
across
the highway there somewhere.
Somewhere.
So, just keep an eye out for that. Use a bit of common sense and just anticipate. But don't try and race them. They're not going to stop, mate. They'll just keep going.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, for the sake of sitting, and I mean, I know that they are incredibly long, but even that, taken into consideration, the worst case scenario, you might sit for like 4 or 5 minutes, I guess, for a train to go through. Whereas the difference could be trying to race it and not quite make it could be the difference between never getting to your destination at all. So what's more important, saving 5 minutes or
You're sitting in a hospital for a few months?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. Have a bit of fun with the kids, and if you've got children that with you, they can try and count the carriages.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea, actually. Now, do they just have the train do they just have the engine at the front, do you know? Or have they got one at the front pulling and one at the back pushing?
They normally pull, just usually the one train.
Okay.
A lot of carriages, and they might just have a light on the stuck on the rear carriage, and that's about it. They're just little almost square carriages and full of chopped up sugar cane. So there's no lighting on them. They can be hard to see. If you're at night, your car headlights will probably be the first thing to see them if you don't see the flashing lights.
Mm-hmm. And they run 24/7, you said?
They do, yeah. The mills run 24/7 during the season. They've got to try and get it all processed as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is to get the cane into the mill as quickly as they can, because the longer it stays in the paddock, the sugar content reduces. So they're pretty keen to harvest it and get it to the mill ASAP to get the best value for money.
Okay. So there you go, listeners, if you're in sugarcane area. What is the sugarcane area? Do you know where it starts and finishes for the benefit of people heading north?
Mostly, and I'll say mostly, is northern New South Wales and most of Queensland.
Okay.
Usually in the more coastal areas, Bundaberg and right up to Innisfail and around Cairns and Tully.
Okay.
They're big sort of sugarcane areas, Mackay, right the way up, but also northern New South Wales have them. It's normally sort of more coastal sort of areas.
Okay.
You'll see it growing along the way. Mm-hmm. The old days, they used to burn the cane.
Right.
And that's a sight to see if you haven't seen that. They don't do it very often now for environmental reasons and better quality harvesters. They'd burn it to get rid of a lot of the leaf when it was manually harvested, and also to get rid of a lot of vermin from the crops.
Okay.
If you see pictures of the old cane cutters and that, they're usually pretty black from cutting the sooty cane.
Right. Well, that reminds me of a song, because Graham Connors wrote a song called Let the Cane Fields Burn. I wonder if that's the reason behind all of that.
Yes, and Ganga Jam, when they're in Bundaberg, they actually wrote the song Sounds of Them.
Ah, okay.
Which refers to the cane fields.
Right. So is there anything else we need to know about the cane fields and what to do and what to look out for the benefit of the listeners?
Just keep an eye out. If you get a chance to go through any museums or anything like that that are related to the sugar cane, it's got a pretty big history, and not all of it's great, where you've got the islanders being blackbirded and brought from over in the Solomons and Tanner Island and those sort of areas,
right?
To work in the cane fields.
Uh-huh.
A lot of them were treated fairly badly. Like there's stories of the ones around the Bundaberg area. There's a couple of cemeteries that are just sort of pushed by the wayside, and islanders were buried in there.
Okay.
They went to the local store to buy some shoes, and they were sold two left shoes, so that they had to go back later on and spend money on another pair of right shoes, so they could actually wear the damn things.
So
that's the sort of things that people were done. One plantation owner is reported to have owned the church, so he encouraged everybody to go to the church and make a donation, because they were told that you had to buy your way into heaven.
Oh, really?
So he paid them a small wage and, got it back on Sunday so they could buy their way down.
Oh, no, really?
So that's the sort of way that, the people were treated back in those days.
Yeah.
There's a very large islander population here in Queensland, et cetera, and a lot of it did stem from, the remnants of the blackbirding and the cane industry.
Okay, so there's some interesting things to look at, and there's also a lot of interesting things to look out for if you're travelling in this area where the cane trains rattle along the side of the road and cross the road.
That's right, yep. Just keep an eye out. Enjoy it. The cane's good to look at. If you do get a chance to see a cane fire, get your camera out. It's a very, very a good thing to see. As I say, they don't do it all that much now, but if you've ever seen a couple of cane fires, which I did many, many ones when I was growing up here in Bundy.
Okay.
They're massive fires, massive fires.
Something to see, something to look out for. All right, mate. Well, there you go. Very interesting for the listeners, and also a little bit of trivia about a couple of songs we just mentioned, and yep. also some things to look out for in relation to the a bit of history in relation to the cane fields and the cane cutting. What sort of a song can we play for you today on this segment, Ken?
Well, we should do the Ganga Jang Sounds of Then. As I say, it was written here in Bundaberg, and there's actually a street named after Ganga Jang.
Okay.
Here in Bundaberg as well.
All right. And that's going back to about 1985, I think, when that band wrote that song.
Mate, that's your area, not mine.
Yeah. And it was written, of course, by the front man of the band. Okay. Matey, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today about cane fields and cane trains and what to look out for.
Always a pleasure, Phil. Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much. And you, my friend, take it easy. Stay safe in one of the best states in Australia. We'll be back with more Roman Oz listeners straight after Sounds of Then by Ganga Jang.
Awkward, it faces west, long diagonals and sloping too. And in the distance, through the heat haze, in convoys of silence, the cattle graze. A certain texture, that certain beat, brings forth the nighttime heat. Ow! Out on the patio, we sit, and the humidity. The lightning crack over cane fields, laugh and think that this is Australia. Yeah.
hope you enjoyed the show, listeners.
If you missed any, check out our Facebook page, Spotify, or romanoz.com.au.
Tune in next week for more
Roman Oz.